Hey guys, welcome back to the Marvel Bronze Age. I'm Ed.
And I am Ed's brother.
Ah, younger brother.
Younger brother.
Younger brother, yes. It's always important to remember our place.
Right.
So, I'm older, and so that means he's younger. Well, it doesn't mean that, but he is.
I am. It's true.
So, yes. We have Marvel books. This is a, as it says, a Marvel comic book podcast. 1970, I think we started January of 1970 with the goal of sometime probably in 85, 86-ish will be the when we reach our terminus. In between, we will do our very best to cover the plethora of books that Marvel put out during that time period.
There were a plethora of books put out.
Indeed.
Yes.
And we won't cover them all. There are were a lot of books that just aren't our type of books. They may be someone else's. We're more than happy to allow them to cover those books from the Marvel Bronze Age.
Mm-hmm.
Romance.
Mm-mm.
The funny ha-ha books.
Mm-mm.
Aren't our thing. And pretty much everything else is. Definitely superhero. Westerns, we're cool with Westerns. I think there will probably be sci-fi books that come through that we'll be cool with.
Mm-hmm.
We won't be doing reprint books, and that kind of comes up between now and next episode, in particular. Marvel, in their schedule, put out several reprint books, and they would occur in the period that Levi and I are talking about between this episode and next. So
right, but we're looking for originals.
Yes, yes. Kind of like origami, but not like it.
Right, exactly.
So up this episode, we have the Incredible Hulk 125 issue to talk about and Iron Man issue 23. And taking a step back, we want to thank McNor for giving us our word of the show for this episode, which we have already managed to work into our discussion. It was one of the easier ones we've had so far. So thank you, McNor, if that's your name.
If that's your real name.
Yes, for suggesting we drop the word plethora.
Plethora.
In an appropriate place.
And there we've done it four times already.
Mm-hmm. I think we did pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So the Incredible Hulk issue 125, which you would think would be kind of an anniversary issue because of the number, but it doesn't appear to be.
Mm-mm.
It's just issue 125.
They seem to just Hulk through it.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Kind of Marvel is in a time frame where far more often than not, the covers actually have something to do with the story.
Mm-hmm.
They're a scene from the story or maybe the lead in to the story that's in the rest of the issue or something. Not just a pretty pinup pose or, you know, something like that. We have an image of the Hulk and the Absorbing Man standing on what appears to be a rocket fighting as the rocket is flying over some planet, which I guess you can assume, there we go,
mm-hmm,
is Earth, being that they're both Earthlings. So probably a safe bet. And there's like a moon up here, which I guess would be our moon, the moon.
Well, if that's Earth, then boy, you are spot on there.
That's it. Now, this star right here would be, no, I'm kidding. I have no idea what those stars are.
That's where the Watchers are from, right there. You see that one?
Yeah, that right there. All right. This issue is brought to us by Stan Lee as the editor, Roy Thomas and Herb Trimpe as writer-artist, and Sam Rosen as letterist. Nothing spoken of as far as inking or coloring, so if one or both of those were done, I would assume it was Herb Trimpe doing the full art, but mm-hmm, I don't know otherwise. So
either that or some intern that doesn't deserve mentioning.
Right. They don't rate a name mention. Yeah. and others. Sometimes, actually, you'll see that, and others.
Just be glad you got to work on a comic. Go get me coffee.
Yeah, yeah, we could have just told you no and sent you on your way.
Exactly. You could still be in a copy room.
The mail room.
Exactly. That.
All right. This Hulk is it's a continuation of a Hulk that has been in the book for a couple, three issues. He's several issues ago, there was a procedure done by the Fantastic Four that modified the Hulk's it allowed the Hulk full access of his alter ego, Dr. Banner's brain, so that the intelligence and the ability to speak and everything like that that Banner possesses as a human being, he continued to possess when he hulked out.
Okay.
There for a while when he hulked out, he went, mindless, savage mm-hmm. beast with very low vocabulary.
Right.
But this is one of, over the course of history, it will prove to be one of many times when the bestial Hulk was at bay for a period of time. As this issue opens, there's a page with Hulk speaking, and you see that his speech is becoming more halting
mm-hmm.
as the process, the procedure, which the Hulk is aware of, is wearing off. And he is starting over time to return when he hulks out to the more bestial, less intelligent creature that he was prior to Reed Richards. Let's see, what did Reed Richards do? He completely disassembled Hulk. He started with an unconscious Hulk. He completely disassembled him down to a subatomic level and then reassembled him. And when he did, he was Bruce Banner. He wasn't the Hulk. And when Bruce Banner revived, he showed that he was okay because he forced his transition into the Hulk and forced it back. So he was in control of the change and maintained his full psyche as the Green Hulk.
Okay. Interesting.
So for the rest of that issue, issue one, I don't know, 22, 23, around in there. It was Bruce Banner, and anytime he hulked, he was a, you know, he was a fully intelligent, cognizant creature. The succeeding issues up until this one also, you see that his speech, you can't really tell necessarily by his behavior because the Hulk's behavior is always rather hulkish and brutish mm-hmm. and, you know. But his speech, it's becoming less and less the normal, proper, refined speech and more that halting, aggressive, verb-heavy kind of speech
right.
that the Hulk does.
Right.
So he's the Hulk also, here we see – now, that's just as, you know, as you've been reading the title. On the second page, you see definitely that he is aware of – this reverting back to his old form because he's bemoaning the fact that he understands that that is happening.
Mm-hmm.
He gets rather melancholy here, decides to take out his melancholia on a car. The car loses, just in case you were wondering. In frustration, I guess, he just collapses under the horrid weight of his plight and falls next to a radio on a blanket on a beach from which he scared the people, the young couple that was here making out
right.
By destroying the car, their car, his car, the boy's car.
Poor guy.
Yeah, really.
Just, you know, Hulk just walks up and because he's in a bad mood, beats his car and throws it into the lake or the ocean or whatever.
And, you know, I bet that's particularly tragic because I kind of suspect that the guy had the pink slip for this car.
Yeah.
Because it looks to me like it's a little Deuce Coupe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Okay, anyways.
I don't think Progressive covers that, though.
Probably. They cover everything else, though.
Yeah, but, you know.
according to the commercials.
Right.
Well, it depends. If he got the pink slip within 2 days,
mm-hmm.
is it 2 days, they say, or 2 weeks?
I'm not sure.
It's covered?
Yeah. But
Hulk collapses, passes out his whatever caused him to change, passes as he's unconscious, and he reverts back to Bruce Banner, mumbling the name Betty as we switch scenes. Again, the trigger and target of his angst is Betty and his relationship with her. The issue just prior to this one, I don't recall specifically, but something happened. He got, maybe jumped by a bad guy or something in the fight between the Hulk and the big evil. He destroyed the house that he and Betty were then living in, injuring her dad.
Mm-hmm.
And then ran off, because of what had happened in his Hulk state that he now was no longer controlling to the extent that he had been just an issue or two prior, on the way to the original non-control form that he'll exhibit, I suspect, here in another, couple issues. He'll be all the way back to the bestial thing. So he's, part of this whole setup for this issue is his feelings about the happiness and the life that he's wanted was in his grasp, and now that it's not within his grasp, he has gone so far as to hurt her dad, and I think at this point he still thinks her.
Mm-hmm.
So, it not only is my life ruined, but in the process of ruination, I hurt my love. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, just another superhero who's got it so bad.
Yeah, being a superhero is really tough.
Mm-hmm.
We cut to, it says, a certain California Air Force Base, and we see that Major Talbot, who is second in command to General Ross, who is Betty's dad, the gentleman that I said was injured, Betty Ross being Bruce Banner's paramour. I don't believe they have gotten married yet in this. Sorry, spoiler. They're not married. And Ross Talbot's goal in their military career has always been to capture the Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
Not only because of the Hulk, but for Thunderbolt Ross, because of what Bruce Banner's relationship has done to his daughter, in that Bruce Banner is the Hulk.
Right.
A whole nasty little love circle.
Mm-hmm.
I say all that to say, as I said, the name Major Talbot. Major Talbot is in love with Betty, but the love is not reciprocated because Betty loves Banner.
What a shock. He's in love with her. She doesn't love him back, so he's got a drive to take down Banner and the Hulk?
Go figure, yeah.
Man.
So Talbot is kind of in charge of things while General Ross is recovering from the past couple issues. And he is told by a member of his unit that a comet is approaching Earth and is apparently on a collision course. There's sure enough about that at this point that they determine that they must do something and put some other things into motion. Talbot goes to update General Ross. General Ross is convalescing. He appears to be at the base in the base's hospital,
mm-hmm.
but he's kind of been relieved of duty because of his injuries. Talbot is in charge of their unit that they work together on. So he goes to update Ross. Betty is there. We also have a little bit of, shall I call it, bemoanation from Betty about the situation being, her and her dad and Bruce and Hulk and, yeah, all that stuff. Very soap opera-y,
mm-hmm.
the Hulk's early life. It it never really changes, but it becomes less a focus over the years and then just starts popping up here and there. This first thing where the Hulk is determined to be a bad guy and Bruce Banner tries to hide it from people, this whole thing, and then Betty, very soap opera-y to begin with.
I think him and Parker and Surfer should just, like, go out to a
night. Oh, man, that would – if they went for beers one night, it would just be horrible.
Seriously.
No, I think they would all be crying drunks.
Well, yes, I believe so, too. Though Hulk, I believe, metabolizes it too quickly. But anyway, I would not want to be on the same planet.
No.
When that happened.
No, that would just, yeah. I think they would actually try to outdo each other with sob stories.
Yes. Yeah.
Talbot tells General Ross about the approaching asteroid. We see that Ross, understands what's going on. It's the end of him being told, and then we switch scenes back to Banner, who is reviving after his collapse for whatever, I guess he just overexerted. And he hears a radio news report talking about this approaching comet. And determines at this point that he will go, probably as Hulk, but also keeping in mind that Bruce Banner is one of the most intelligent physicist or astrophysicist in the Marvel Universe, so he potentially could also lend his assistance that way. Mm-hmm. Going to lend his assistance one way or the other to this comet issue. Cutting back to the airport base, we see that a gentleman is looking for Talbot, finds him and tells him that he has we see that a gentleman is going to try to find Talbot. In the background, we see that Talbot has been called to meet somebody. Mm-hmm. And a couple panels later, the gentleman with news and Talbot meet in the same room, and we see that the call was for Major Talbot to meet Bruce Banner, who has been arrested, detained.
Yeah, he turned himself in.
Yeah, because of suspicion, the grunts that have him don't know if he is who he says he is because he's not carrying any ID, but he does have his purple pants.
Well, of course he does. That should be his ID.
There's an MMA fighter whose nickname is the Hulk, mm-hmm. and he always wears purple shorts.
Nice.
So he obviously is a fan of the comic book.
Either that or someone told him to do it and he still has no idea why.
Why? Yeah, it could be. It's just marketing. Mm-hmm. So Talbot and Banner, have a little convo there, and Talbot accepts Banner's help, which always seems questionable at best, mm-hmm. for anyone that knows Banner's story. Once that happens, it's only a matter of time before the Hulk appears.
Yeah, right? And it's like, wait, so I know who you are, and I know what happens, and you're offering me help. Oh,
right, yeah. It's always equally suspicious for those stories where Banner turns out to be in a spaceship, mm-hmm. or a space station or in a submarine, or you're like, but you know who he is.
Yeah, and here's the dilemma that the person who's making the decision has to look at. Okay, one, I can say yes because I know we can use him. He will help. Okay. I can say no and I'll piss him off.
Well,
we know what happens when he gets angry.
Right. So, but I almost think I would rather piss him off there than in a submarine at the bottom of the Marianas Trench.
Well, yeah. I mean, definitely that, and or in space or on another planet or
yeah, it's a matter of odds. I think my odds are better.
Yeah, it's
terrestrially on Earth,
Yeah, so. Terrestrially based. it's the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
But it sucks that they're just both evil because it's like, okay, now I don't like you. I want to put you in prison, but I know I need your help.
Right, yeah. Plus you've got my woman, just to be the icing on the cake.
Exactly. Everybody loves Betty White, so.
Okay. Betty White, yeah, I heard that.
Oh, I know.
So Talbot tells Banner about the plan that has been put into motion back when he Talbot spoke to General Ross, because General Ross kind of told him to do it and was going to jump up and take charge, but was reminded of his delicate condition by Talbot and Betty. Mm-hmm. And so he ended up staying in his room recovering. And the plan is to send the concern is that the comet is going to pass by Earth.
Mm-hmm. We're going to actually revolve or spin into its tail or its wake. And they're saying that this comet's tail is extremely radioactive. I think they use poison or poisonous instead of radioactive.
Yeah, they say poison.
Because, you know, you don't want to talk about radioactivity back then.
Right. Well, not only that, but, you know, that may be something that Banner is looking for.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
So.
But, yeah, so that's what's going to happen to the planet. It's not it's an extinction level, you know.
Poisoning? Is this like the first hintings of like Ebola?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
So I flipped through the book, but I never saw Dustin Hoffman in a containment suit anywhere.
Well, that was page 13.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It was bottom left. It was just a little thing. He was in the background.
What was the name of his movie? Was that Outbreak?
Wasn't it Outbreak?
Dustin Hoffman? Was it Outbreak?
Yeah.
Was his?
Yeah.
Okay, the plan, given that this is what's going to occur between the intersection of the comet and the Earth, is to head the comet off, of course, prior to getting too close to the Earth,
mm-hmm.
by firing a rocket ship,
mm-hmm.
that is outfitted with a nuclear warhead.
Mm-hmm.
And as pass the rocket ship near the comet and detonate the warhead with the hope of, at the very least, throwing it off its current track,
mm-hmm.
if not perhaps even destroying the comet itself.
Right. And I gotta say, I love the classic name of the rocket.
The
X-890.
Yes, there we go. The drawback is that they can't do this from a control room. They don't have drone technology yet, so they have to have a pilot. And this is where Bruce Banner comes in.
Mm-hmm.
He volunteers to pilot this ship because it more than likely will not come back.
Yeah.
And given that he can turn into the Hulk, I suppose, the chances of him coming back are better than just a normal human being.
But do you really think that that's how he's weighing it?
No.
Especially at this point with everything that's gone on in the past?
No, he's not wanting to come back.
Exactly.
Yeah, he's like – it never says it here. But, yeah, given everything, my assumption was that, well, he just hopes he doesn't come back. This is his – death by rocket ship.
Yep.
is what he's hoping for.
And and hopefully, you know, this will help to maybe make up for all the wrong that he's done.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Not as make amends. I guess, is that the right word? He's hoping that it will make amends.
Yeah. That term seems so insufficient.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure that word even really has a whole lot of value given the way that it's typically used.
Mm-hmm.
So the launch goes off without a snag. Bruce Banner is there, takes off, intersects the comet. Now they have some kind of screen that they're actually able to watch. It's not a close up screen, but it's enough for them to see what is happening.
Yeah, it could be a satellite, like real time.
Okay, yeah. And so the trajectory of the rocket takes it through the tail for detonation, which I would think would be too far out of the comet's path. Because by the time you enter its tail, isn't it going to be like 10,000 miles away? You know, so
depends on how close. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. So
that's Banner.
It gets in there. There's a couple panels of, you know, the horrid conditions that the rocket is undergoing as it's flying through the tail. It does manage to eject or jettison or fire whatever their method of the warhead. The warhead does explode. We see that the rocket ship escapes the explosion. It's not caught or seemingly damaged in any way in the explosion. Initially, as far as we can tell, the assumption is that he delivered the payload and now he's returning home.
Mm-hmm. Without any complications so far, because the tail was supposed to be poisonous.
Well, correct. Yeah, we the mission was accomplished. He doesn't appear to be affected.
Mm-hmm.
The ship doesn't appear to be adversely affected. Mm-hmm. Everything is going A-okay so far.
Mm-hmm.
We see him, excuse me, talking or thinking that everything's okay. I'll flip on the autopilot and just coast on home. Next panel, we see a figure crouching, holding on to the outside of the rocket.
Yeah, now, see, this threw me because I was like, when I looked at it, I was like, wait, isn't he in space?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Close-up panel and then full face-on panel, we see that the figure that somewhere or another, as he's flying around, that Bruce Banner has picked up on the outside of the rocket ship is none other than Crusher Creel, known in the Marvel Universe as the villain, the Absorbing Man.
And now, having not read the issues as to, we'll say, why he is where he is, I went back through and I was like, where did he climb onto the spaceship? I was actually looking back through this issue.
Right.
Because I thought I missed something. I'm like, where did he climb onto the, where, what did I miss? There's nothing. What the heck?
So you're saying that you never reached that understanding yet?
Well,
not, or you did.
Not before this. Now, of course, after reading the rest of the comic, yeah, I know what happened. But it was just, I'm saying that, you know, when I see, you know, here's the Absorbing Man and he's on the outside of the spaceship and the spaceship's still out in space, I was just like, what did I miss?
Right. What did you guys drop a page or?
Well, I mean, maybe because it's like one of those like launch scenes.
Right.
And there's a little itty bitty silhouette that you got to pay attention to so that you can follow the storyline. So I went back and I'm like looking at all the spaceship and the rocket and I'm like, I don't see anything. When did he do that?
Yeah, I can see that. Up to this point, it feels like perhaps there's been another one of those leaps like we talked about last episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you're like, okay, well, they did it again because I looked and I don't see anything, mm-hmm. but here he is. The Absorbing Man, if – I'm not a whole lot of a villain fan. For me, I read comic books for the heroes, and the heroes are supposed to be good, and the heroes are supposed to win. And, that, you know, I buy into that whole aspect of heroes. So there really aren't any bad guys necessarily that I – look forward to seeing or want to see or any, because they're just going to be beat by the good guys because that's what's supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But as close as any villains in the Marvel Universe come to, the Absorbing Man, in my mind, is one of the cooler ones. He has the ability to transmute his person into a state replicating whatever he has touched. So he physically can turn into the same thing that he touches, whether it be sand or water or granite or iron or et cetera, et cetera. But he also takes on the characteristics of those things. So he is susceptible to magnets if he's a ferrous metal.
Right.
He's susceptible to disassociation if he turns into water in the middle of the ocean. Mm-hmm. Same thing if he turns into sand in a desert. You know, so he takes on the characteristic weaknesses of these things he changes into,
right.
Or just in general their attributes, whatever the attributes might be.
But he
go ahead.
But he can also do that with people.
Apparently so. I think the easiest way to think about what the absorbing man does is think of it in terms of energy.
Yeah.
Don't think of it in terms of a physical touching. Mm-hmm. Think of it in terms of energy, because if you really get down to it, the differences in elements is just a matter of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, to be a certain element, he just absorbs and mimics a particular pattern of energy.
Right.
For anything. And so that, if you look at it that way, that makes it more, you know, believable, I guess, if you want,
mm-hmm.
for a couple things that happen in this issue. And on down the road, there will be, in his career, there will be changes that aren't necessarily physical, which just out and out shows you that it's not necessarily a brick and mortar kind of thing that he changes into.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, that comes up a couple times, here in the book. So the absorbing man, yeah, very, very cool to me because he can set himself up to be, the opposite or the thing that is needed to beat just about any hero. He would be the perfect device for a writer, because a writer could write him defeating just about any hero you can think of somehow.
Well, I mean, yeah, if he has the extent that you're talking about of being able to absorb, take on attributes and characteristics of energy types, okay. Maybe.
Well, it would almost make him a MacGuffin character.
Well, I mean, it's just the ones who don't really seem to have, say, the proverbial silver bullet.
Right.
It's just a matter of out punching them or out doing them in stamina or whatever. That might be a little difficult. I'd have to see how he did it. You know what I mean? Because I mean, let's take Hulk. Sure, he can turn into the hardest material if he can touch it in the galaxy. Is that going to be enough to beat Hulk? If Hulk gets mad enough, is he going to be able to punch that? It's just.
Right, and straight up, you're right. Probably not. The absorbing man's weakness is his lack of intelligence, his lack of creativity in using his power. Now, that plays out in this issue in a very backwardy, non-directed kind of way.
Yeah.
By Bruce Banner and the Hulk. But ultimately, that's what it amounts to. The absorbing man gets outsmarted.
Yeah.
And typically, after you know, assuming these forms that cannot be beaten and pummeling and winning and all, ultimately he just flat out almost always gets outsmarted.
Yeah, and usually what it is he gets cocky, he gets arrogant, and he misses some little thing, and that's the major thing. And yeah,
right. Yeah, you know, he doesn't realize he's standing over.
Yeah,
or he has grasped a hold of, or, you know, so even though he has built the character is designed as a, whatever we called it, a Mary or whatever the role playing character is that can't be beat because he's too strong.
Mm-hmm.
He also automatically, as part of the character, has that built in switch that you can use to defeat him whenever you want to as the writer.
Right.
So he's perhaps not as fleshed out, as full a character as some, you know, other villains, Dr. Doom, or, you know, some, but, you know, if you just want that, man, I want to put my character or my team up against somebody that just kicks their butt for a little while. And well, that, you know, that's the Absorbing Man.
Mm-hmm.
He came to town trying to rob a bank and grabbed a hold of a building and turned into brick.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so
he touched a manhole cover.
There you go. It's, you know, and another cool thing I've always thought about the Absorbing Man, and I forget exactly where he got it, but he carries around a wrecking ball.
Yeah, I noticed that.
On a chain, and it also will transmute into whatever, if he is holding it. So,
which makes me wonder if he can transfer his ability to other things other than that wrecking ball and chain.
I'm sorry. Chef Terry has corrected me and says that it's not a wrecking ball. It's a ball and chain from prison.
Oh, he's married? Ooh. Oh,
there goes 75% of the female listenership.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Or at least all of the female list, or all of the listenership that identifies as the female gender.
Mm.
We lost all of those. So.
Good.
And here, in this appearance, he is metallic somehow. We'll go, I guess, just off the fact that he's holding onto the rocket, so maybe he's rocket plating. You know, who knows?
I believe it said specifically that because he was holding onto the rocket.
Oh, did it? Oh,
okay. Yeah. He
wasn't trying to be obtuse.
He turned into it so that he could survive everything and, you know.
Okay. Next, after all that talking about the Absorbing Man, if you guys want to learn any more, Google. He probably has a wiki page. I know he has a Marvel wiki page. So
he does.
All the information there. Next page, we see where and why and how he ended up on the rocket.
Yeah.
Turns out that the comet itself had formed around Crusher.
Mm-hmm.
In Thor 123, which to learn of those exploits, if you go to the Comic Book Noise Network, you can download the Mighty Thorcast episode 18, wherein the hosts talked about Thor issue 123. And see that Thor defeated Crusher by literally throwing him into space as hard as he could. Crusher was in a state that he could not halt his momentum. So he just continued going and going and going, deep space, whatever. Came across the path of this comet, became one with the essence of the comet Toric energy.
Cometoric.
Cometoric.
Man, that should have been the word of the show.
There we go. That's a difficult one to use in any other way, but how I did. So.
Right. Well, it could also mean someone was really funny.
Could be. And there's a really poor taste Robin Williams joke in there somewhere, but I won't
do it. Yeah.
I'll let that one go. I was very saddened by that, just to throw that out there. I kind of grew up with Robin Williams, so he's always been around. I've always known of him since his Mork and Mindy days.
Weren't you two about the same age?
No. On Happy Days, I remember watching the original airing of Happy Days that Mork from Ork first showed up on. So I have had the opportunity to follow his career since then in real time.
Mm-hmm.
It's been kind of cool. But Absorbing Man, so
comet,
what happened
absorbed.
Is – yeah, cometoric.
Cometoric.
As the comet was blown up and or because Bruce Banner passed nearby, the absorbing man was conscious enough to realize that he had an opportunity to escape his current situation or change his current situation, and so grasped on to the ship, immediately turning into like material as the ship is. After we see all this in the story, we see that Bruce has a rear view camera.
Yes.
And notices that there's somebody hitching a ride here.
Yes.
And I guess just merely because of the fact that they're not supposed to be there, he starts to Hulk out.
Well, wouldn't you get a little freaked out if you're like in a rocket ship and you look in your rear view finder and you see this metal dude just like on the outside of your ship?
Yeah. But I mean, you know, as much as I dislike being the Hulk, if dude's not being aggressive, you know, do I really want to change? Because I don't like the Hulk.
Mm.
I don't want to be with him. I don't want to use him. I don't, you know, so I mean.
Yeah, but Banner's just so skittish.
Well, oh, yeah, that's part of his personality. So, Crusher realizes that this person is reacting. He doesn't necessarily realize who it is, but he sees that they're reacting to his presence, decides to do something, I guess, with his ball and chain. He decides that he's going to try to defeat them by destroying the rocket that he's flying on.
I think he was trying to kill the dude.
And under the assumption, I guess, that he will survive it?
Well, I mean, I'm assuming he thinks since he's metal that when it crashes, he'll just roll and pop. I don't know, but I mean, he says.
Yeah, it's I mean, he says, his motivation is a little lacking.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, he does say, too bad he ain't gonna live to tell nobody about it.
So I guess that's what he is. He's trying to stop him from telling anybody.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
we'll go with that then. That makes the most sense.
The Hulk breaks through the rocket, and now both of them are walking along the top curve, you know, of the rocket, fighting. And the rocket we see is heading now straight towards the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, it may have been flying in a path to perhaps land somewhere, or, you know, crash, as it were, into water somewhere, or something less destructive. But now, because of the Hulk and because of the damage that Crusher did to it, no steering, no flying, dropping.
Yep.
It's just – and it does indeed crash with a mighty shroom, not the edible kind.
Oh.
The big explosive kind, although it is in pink letters.
It is, right?
The explosive kind. The Hulk kind of scrabbles out of the remains of the rocket first, only to be smacked by Crusher's wrecking ball as Crusher attacks him in mortal form.
Yeah, in the fleshy form?
Yeah, flesh form, I guess would be. Now, to me, this brings up a point.
Yeah.
I don't know any better. So I would assume that dude, I mean, you know, looking at him, is big and strong. But he's big and strong human. Okay? He is, you know, I don't know, Hulk Hogan or, you know, Andre the Giant or whatever kind of strong. Mm-hmm. Just normal strong. The Hulk grabs the ball and whips Crusher Creel, who is holding the chain end, into the ground head first.
Mm-hmm.
And it does no damage to Crusher.
Mm-mm.
So I guess the process, Chef Terry, do you remember Crusher Creel's origin? Was it in the Thor book? Do you remember how he got his powers? Loki gave him powers, or did he give him some of Thor's hammer power? Or okay, so his power is Asgardian based, so it's possible that he also gained the Asgardian durability.
Hmm. Okay, that would make more sense than what you can glean from the pages.
Yeah, this, and there's another instance where this very same type of thing comes up.
Mm-hmm.
So I can go with that, I guess, given that he got his powers from Loki. You would think that Loki would be smart enough to add, you know, not just the ability to absorb, but let's, you know, let's pump him up mm-hmm. a little bit too.
Right.
So, okay.
A metahuman or superhuman or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So now they start going hand to hand. Hulk picks up a huge section of the rocket here and flings it at Crusher. Only it turns out it's not just a huge section of the rocket. It is the nuclear engine for the rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And so in hitting Crusher, Crusher is able to transmute his form into that of whatever type of radiative energy the engine used for propulsion.
Yeah.
He becomes that energy form, whatever. Maybe he is just radioactive. But he comes out all glowy red.
Yeah.
So, and he also is able to project in kind of a limited way that same energy that makes up his being, because what he does is he shoves his hand into the ground and starts liquefying the terra firma
mm-hmm.
between he and Hulk, so that Hulk starts to submerge in it like quicksand.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns into a red hot quicksand, more like lava than like, you know, like a liquefied rock, liquefied earth is what the Hulk finds himself standing on. Crusher believes that he has defeated the Hulk because as the Hulk is starting to sink, he just apparently falls face forward, like he collapses. And is covered by the liquid earth. But what Crusher can't see, but we can because we have the magic of perspective,
mm-hmm.
is that the Hulk has dove down and is swimming, cutting, digging his way in a nice arc from where he was to come up where Crusher is, which he does. Knocks Crusher for a loop, which I guess kind of staggers his concentration mm-hmm. because once again, Crusher reverts to his more fleshy form.
Mm-hmm.
Hulk reverses the trick that, or no, I'm sorry, it's the same trick. He grabs an end of the prison ball and chain, and uses it to fling Crusher, this time head first into a mountain, face first, like a big flesh missile.
Mm-hmm.
That has really
mm-hmm.
dirt.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, like a human rocket. There we go.
Mm-hmm.
And again, does Crusher no harm? So, I mean, he has to have increased fleshy durability for somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, going back to what Chef Terry recalled of his origin, I guess that is what happened. Loki gave him, you know, increased durability, Asgardian-level durability. It was an enchanted potion composed of rare Asgardian herbs, she reads on the wiki.
Ah, so that means he's got like a constitution of 18.
I'd say it's an 18 like slash 53.
All right.
Wait, can you bump up constitution? I mean, I know you can do strength, but
Yeah, you can bump up constitution.
Only artificially though, because it could you have a character that stayed at that constitution, or would it?
No,
would it have to be a time limit?
No. You, depending on how it was done, yeah, you could have a character whose constitution stayed permanently at 50, 20.
Right. Yeah. Whatever. Well, that would be. I never ran into that. The only time I ever saw the slash was with strength.
Yeah.
So, sorry for those of you that are not D&D people. Okay.
Your childhood was just a little worse.
Oh, yeah. It was a little bit duller.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's for sure. Hulk and Crusher are still fighting now. The Crusher has become one with the type of stone that the mountain was,
yeah.
Whatever it was. And the next panel after Crusher turns, we see from the perspective of a small group, 2, 4, 6 people that are watching the fight from a distance. Mm-hmm. We are in amongst them as they are viewing the fight, whereas previously we were right there at the fight.
Right.
So now we know that somebody is watching them and apparently not, you know, all screaming, running skittish about the fight. They must be interested in what's going on because they're staying there watching.
Yep, wherever Hulk and
Crusher,
wherever they landed, these people just happened to either be close by or came to it.
Yeah, whatever. They turn up there.
Yeah, they're just calmly standing there watching.
So we have a couple panels with them, the people watching here amongst other panels on this one page. No one ever says anything.
No. Nope.
They all look normal human.
Yep.
So as far as we can tell, it's just a bunch of spectators, not even paparazzi, nope. Just spectators. Mm-hmm. The Hulk, in the midst of this fight, or let's see. Or yeah, okay. I'm sorry. Crusher. Gets close enough to the Hulk in their fight that he grabs hold of the Hulk and turns big green hulking gamma monster too.
Mm-hmm. He's a bit hulky.
Yeah, whatever you want to call the substance that the Hulk is made of, mm-hmm. Crusher turns into that too. And using that phenomenal strength, he reaches down, grabs up a huge piece of earth, mm-hmm. Rock, you know, whatever they're standing on, huge giant piece. Is standing over Banner going to, like, fly, swatter, smush him. But turns out that he is standing on the Hulk, directly on the Hulk, in booted feet.
Yeah.
I might also add.
Yeah.
But he's standing over the Hulk, I guess due to having some of his essence drawn out of him by the Absorbing Man, has collapsed. And not only collapsed, but he reverts back to Bruce Banner.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is in contact with Bruce Banner, Crusher Creel reverts to his more human-y, fleshy kind of form,
mm-hmm.
which turns out to not be strong enough to sustain the massive piece of earth that he has held over his head.
Right.
Bruce wakes up enough to get out of the way. And right before this rock stuff that Crusher is holding, right before it falls and smushes him, Crusher changes to the same substance, but the stuff still falls on him.
Yep.
So that means it falls on him and defeats him, but it doesn't kill him and squish him.
Well.
So he'll be able to come back.
We can assume that possibility, yeah.
Well, that's my take is that's the whole reason.
Yeah.
So that you don't have to try to explain how he survived. Mm-hmm. You know,
he became the Rock.
He was one with the Rock.
He was one with the Rock.
Final panel, Bruce Banner, when he crawled away, collapsed somewhere, you know, away from the rocky rubble fall. And in the distance behind him, we see who we assume to be these same figures that have been watching,
mm-hmm.
Still watching, perhaps even approaching the fallen Bruce Banner. You can't really tell. There's no sense of movement in the drawing.
No.
And that's where we end. Next issue is either individually entitled or the start of a story arc that is entitled Comes the Nightcrawler.
Yep.
And unfortunately, Levi was turned out to be disappointed, or I disappointed him.
You did.
Because of the title and his association with another character by that name. And
so. The fact that the onlookers could have possibly been other characters.
Right. They could have been. They could have been. All right. So what is your take on that issue of the Hulk?
My take is, first of all, I'll give it a thumbs up.
Okay.
All right. Overall, I liked it. It had a lot of action. It had a lot going on. It was fighting. To me, it was a classic Hulk and Hulk really is one of my more favorite characters simply because he smashes.
Okay.
And, you know, where others are really strong but have to hold themselves back, or really strong but are, you know, morally obligated not to do certain things, a lot of times, and especially with the earlier Hulks, it was just Hulk smash. And I like that. I like the fact that if, you know, he didn't do it, there was always the possibility that you could just aim this very, very, very blunt weapon in the general direction of what you were wanting to accomplish, and he would eventually get around to destroying the bad guy.
Right. Okay.
There are just blazing inconsistencies with, I don't want to say storyline, but maybe the concept of absorbing man's powers.
Okay.
How they work. The biggest thing was the whole shoe thing. As he's lifting up the big piece of the mountain, and he's got it above him because he's absorbed the Hulk's powers.
Yeah.
And then he's stepping on the back of the Hulk, while the Hulk is transforming back into Bruce. The most obvious thing is he can absorb through shoes.
Well, yeah. Previously, it appeared to have been skin contact with mm-hmm. whatever it was. And if he can do it with shoes on, that means, limited though it may be, he should be able to absorb from a distance.
In theory, right? Yeah, in theory.
Yeah, because it doesn't require skin contact.
Right.
So, hence a distance.
Right.
So then you're like, well, why doesn't he just practice standing over here and going yeah. and absorbing the power? You know, so, yeah. But he never does. Even
no.
to this day, it requires skin contact for him to change.
The other thing was on that last page, you see him. He's got – okay, so the Crusher is Hulk-like. He has this huge – and it's got a weigh probably about as much as a blue whale or more piece
oh, yeah.
of rock
yeah,
above his head.
It's huge.
And he has one foot on the back of Banner now because Banner has gone all the way from Hulk back to Banner. He has one foot on him. He's got to be supporting the stone with both feet. He's not balancing.
Okay, right.
And yet Banner is not broken.
Right, right.
So I was just like, he should be like a puddle right now. You know,
well,
because all that
yeah.
weight, you know, just so. I mean, it was just, like I said, just a few things that were just like, guys, can you just get like exactly how his powers work down and then just work from there instead of like experimenting in the issue, you know?
So if I may, mm-hmm. it sounds like that one of the issues you had was perhaps the suspension of too much disbelief.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, yeah, I can.
I mean, because, like, you know, he was out in space. Okay. He's the absorbing man. Who knows what happened there? Whatever.
Right, right.
He somehow got onto the rocket. He touched the rocket. Now he's made of the metal that the rocket's made of. Okay. Whatever. He wants to kill this innocent guy because he doesn't want them telling him that he's coming to Earth. Okay.
Right.
He's the
right.
bad guy. He's an ex-criminal. Okay, whatever. He flies face first into things and is thrown by the Hulk, but he doesn't die. He can absorb through his boot, and he doesn't like, and Bruce Banner doesn't get squished. So
right, yeah. He can levitate as well,
apparently, or hover.
Yeah, right. Okay. All very valid points, giving that you're not describing anything that wasn't drawn on the page. I mean, you know, that's all we have to go off
right.
of is what they give us. And All of those are things they gave us, and they don't necessarily they don't line up, or they don't go anywhere as far as telling us beforehand, oh yeah, by the way, to, you know, to set some things, these things up for us so we understand how they work. I guess still at this point in the Marvel Universe, they just didn't believe it was necessary to explain things like that to their audience. I mean, they just didn't.
And, you know, I don't want this to sound bad to the people that were reading back then, but I think a lot of people may have been less critical.
Okay.
Of how things worked, especially when you're dealing with, this is super powered. This is beyond normal. So what really is normal?
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so I can see them doing that, but, with everything that we've read and we've seen now, you know, and how things are presented, you know, it's kind of just one of those, no, don't buy that.
Oh yeah, I can certainly say that for the current, the modern today readers, those kind of things would not be allowed to occur.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reader would not accept it,
mm-hmm.
and the writers, and by some small extension, the artists, know that they have to fill in all those gaps. Or, you know, they'll just turn people off. They won't buy their book. The book will fail, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So the creative environment, particularly with our era of social media, and the product that is both created and consumed is vastly different than what it is we're reading.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most.
It's a completely different world. The superhero, well, you know, even narrowing it down, the superhero world from Marvel.
Right.
Same company, completely different product. Now, if you went out and bought, actually you can buy titles for both of these characters. They both have current titles, the Hulk and our next book, Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different read.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the art will still be the same. Some of these guys that have drawn on these still draw now. So, I mean, you might even run into the same artist, but the writing is completely different, just totally different.
Right.
And for me, that's one of the things that draws me to the Bronze Age in particular, is that it was just not as – it was just not as serious.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know? And – perhaps when I say serious, you say, you know, it wasn't as well crafted because the readers, the consumers, weren't as critical of the product.
Well, see, I want to use the term hyper real, you know,
right?
In that everything has to, it has to fall into place and to make sense and to be, and this is going to sound weird, but to be able to be scientifically backed up.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. The Marvel physics has to prove that this can happen.
Exactly, exactly.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, even for that to even exist, those physics have to be based on our real-life physics to some extent, somehow.
Well, either that, or they have to have had a whole career of just making up their own.
Yes.
And
yes,
then, of course, you could argue, well, no, if you'll go back to so-and-so issue number, that was proven that didn't work, but, you know.
Right, yeah, yeah. So-and-so discovered this certain type of particle mm-hmm. that allowed mm-hmm. – yeah. Yeah, you're right. I give the book a thumbs up. The mindless hulking monster – appeals to me more than the in control intelligent monster as far as the Hulk.
Yeah.
And as I said, probably at too much length for people listening, I dig the absorbing man.
Right.
I think he is such a a beautiful bad guy to put up against a tank. When you've got the tank character and you need a tank villain, call in the Absorbing Man. Just there.
Yeah, because, you know, instead of going with, you know, oh my God, Hulkbuster technology.
No. You know, you don't even have to stretch your brain that hard. Put the Absorbing Man in a high-rise construction site and throw in your good guy. That, you know, that's all the material Absorbing Man will need.
Yep.
And you can run with it.
Yep.
So, yeah. Okay, so that is a thumbs up from both of us on the Incredible Hulk 125.
Yep.
A non-anniversary issue, unfortunately.
Oh.
It was just regular size, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing special, just another tale.
Yep.
All right, we move on to the Invincible Iron Man 23, which puts us pretty early in his career.
Yeah, it does.
Early enough that there is like 4 or 5 or 6 references in this story to previous issues.
Okay.
Where you know, they're just basically they're showing that they're setting up still the Iron Man mythos.
Right.
And you know, still weaving it around into a full tapestry rather than just like one line that they just keep stitching forever.
Right.
Okay, let's see. The cover, the cover is something that pertains to the story.
Mm-hmm.
We see the Iron Man flying in towards a boat of some sort. Apparently, there's a deck gun on the prow. No, not prow.
Mm.
Fore of the boat.
The deck.
The foredeck.
Sure.
Of the boat. Firing at Iron Man because we see shell bursts around him. The big draw for the story is the man who killed Tony Stark, it says on the cover. And then there are some text bubbles, which I've never been a fan of actual character text bubbles on a cover.
Not on the cover.
You have this big, beautiful chance for one picture. Don't put word balloons on that, too.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I don't want to read the cover. I want to look at the cover. I want to open it. Then I want to start reading.
Right, yeah. And then a little narrative box also on the cover. So you have cover image, text bubbles, narrative bubble, title.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe a bit of overkill to get me to buy that one.
Now, I do want to bring up one thing.
Okay.
And it's, you know, it's something that has become relevant – well, not become relevant. Something that is being talked about more often is the representation of the male characters versus the female characters in comic books. And I would just like to say I want to encourage everyone to find this issue, look at this cover, and understand that they tried to make the Iron Man – look just as sexy as females at that time, because that is a well clad bottom.
Dare you say an iron bum?
An iron bum, yes, and it is it is defined and detailed like no other I have yet seen.
Yes. This is very true. For those of you that have recently railed against a Spider-Woman cover that made the internet. Look up the cover for The Invincible Iron Man, first volume, issue 23, and take a gander at
that
bum of the male character for this book.
Yes.
And see what you think.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Inside, we see that this is also edited by Stan Lee. It's written by Archie Goodwin, drawn by George Tuska, inked by Joe Guadioso, and lettered by Gene Izzo. This issue starts off, I think, I don't recall off the top of my head the previous issue, but I don't think it ended here. So I think this issue opens right in the middle of something that Iron Man is doing.
Okay.
Kind of a little unusual for any character. You know, usually the book will have a definite beginning, middle, end.
Mm-hmm.
But this almost felt like middle middle, end. Because we open the book and he's in the midst of doing
something. Yeah, he's already taking care of stuff, so.
Yeah, he's on a mission, and we're seeing the culmination, the finishing of the mission, is what we see in the first couple pages, page and a half here. He is attacking, I guess, the ship that we saw on the cover.
Yep.
And has decided to rip off of the ship and throw into the ocean this deck gun that we see on the cover firing at him.
Yep.
So he then, having dispatched the gun, dives into the ocean and uses, you know, whatever, his jet boots or whatever, to propel himself off, turn, and then come back at the ship as a human torpedo.
Yes.
Not a fleshy torpedo like Crusher Creel was doing. This is a metallic iron mannish torpedo. A superheroic torpedo. Goes through the ship. Ship starts to sink. Iron Man makes a rather callous remark about, like all rats, they're quick to desert a sinking ship. As the men are jumping into the ocean trying to get away from the boat that he has just sunk.
And he is not helping.
No. Well, no, he did help because he says the Navy will be equally fast picking them up once they're alerted. So you assume that he also alerts rescue, but he says once they're alerted, so it's possible that he left and he left somebody else to alert.
Well, no, because if you look at the next panel, where he left off, he says once they're alerted, and then the next panel by my built-in transmitter. So
so he sent the message to help pick these people
right
up
to the Navy.
Next panel, Iron Man is at a cemetery, pining over the marker of one Janice Cord, died 1969, which conceivably is the year that this is occurring, because he's distraught because this has just recently occurred.
Right, which I enjoyed that because it gave an insight into specifically when this was written.
And then we start to see the filling in of the story of Janice Cord's death, which relates back to the previous, again, two or three issues of Iron Man's story in his book here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's we are in the midst of a continuation of what has been going on, even though it might not be the freshest thing in my memory. Iron Man fought the Crimson Dynamo, and he fought the Titanium Man.
Mm-hmm.
The Titanium Man, in attacking Iron Man, was responsible for Janice Cord's death, and Iron Man was in turn seemingly responsible for the Titanium Man's destruction.
Mm-hmm.
That was undoubtedly the culmination of some, you know, some issue here previously of Iron Man. We see, you know, that he's upset about the fact that he, as Iron Man, wasn't able to stop this, was the cause of this, either or both, whichever.
Mm.
And also that as he is in this graveyard bemoaning the plight of poor Janice, he is being targeted from afar. We then see the person doing the targeting is holding a rifle-esque weapon and is going through stepwise what he would do to kill Iron Man if he had been hired to kill Iron Man.
Right.
But that's not what he's been hired to do.
Yep.
He has been hired to, I would assume, kill someone else that he is watching Iron Man, because Iron Man will lead him to him ultimately.
Right.
Or her. That, you know, that's kind of what you gather. That's not explicitly said, but that's as I'm reading, that's what I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
We find out that the gentleman, as we see that it is a gentleman, has the moniker The Mercenary. He has a helmet with ear coverings and quasi antennae, not a helmet, more a cowl.
Yep.
some sort of maybe armorish stuff or equipment on his breastplate.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of an early stormtrooper.
Okay. It doesn't look like armor, and it doesn't necessarily look like it's like equipment pouches or things like that, but it doesn't necessarily have a repetitive shape or form, like it's something everywhere. It's just kind of mismatched here.
Yeah.
And his outfit is blue and green and yellow.
Mm-hmm.
So that's and he's doing this at night trying to hide also. And apparently he's successful because Iron Man didn't realize he was there.
Yeah. So next time I go out at night, I'm going to try to put on some blue and green and yellow and see if I mix in.
Well, now also, to be most effective, you will have to do so in the trees surrounding a cemetery. Maybe that's important.
That might be. I'll have to try one without and one with.
Exactly, to see if that is the optimal location for the blue, yellow, green camo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is the outlying forest surrounding a cemetery,
right,
situation. That's, yeah.
And apparently the forest is either in late autumn or early winter or late winter, early spring, because there are no tree there are no leaves.
Right, not a one. Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, you even know more so that perhaps it's a seasonal locational camo.
Yep.
So it'll make it a little harder to test because you'll have to wait for that particular season.
But and now what was funny was when I saw the dude for the first time, I was like, he looks like that guy that was like part of – was it the Avengers?
Yellow Jacket?
Yes.
With the cowl and the antenna ear things? Yeah, that looks very Yellow Jacket-like.
And see, I was like – and so I was wondering who came first. Did this guy or did Yellow Jacket?
I've never seen The Mercenary before, so I'll just throw out Yellow Jacket.
Okay. Because, I mean, you look at him and seriously, like with the antennae and the ear things and the cowl and it was just like, that looks like Yellow Jacket.
Oh, yeah, absolutely does. I would suspect that this is probably a one-off bad guy.
Mm.
Just created by, who was it? Archie Goodwin. Mm. He probably came up with the concept and he went to George and said, George, throw me something together for this guy.
Yeah.
And George is like, okay, I'll get it to you next week. And here is The Mercenary.
Yep.
Because, you know, there was a lot of time and effort put into that name.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that I have no doubt there were sleepless nights with that one.
Yeah, that right away tells me that this is just a one-off bad guy for this story. We cut back to not back to, because we haven't seen him yet. We cut to Tony Stark. He is packing, looking at a picture. If you look closely at the picture, you see that perhaps it bears the name Janice Kor. No, I guess not.
Mm-mm. You cannot get Janice or Kor out of that. I don't know who that is.
You could get Janice off of that first name.
Mm, okay.
Maybe. But yeah, okay. So there's a picture here, and they make a point to throw it up there, but you can't really read. It's signed. I don't know. Maybe because he's famous, maybe this is like a movie star of the time or something.
Mm.
And he has an autographed picture. But he's packing. He goes downstairs, throwing his suitcase in the back of the car, getting ready to take off. And he runs into a gentleman with the last name Sitwell, who is a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent who has been assigned to be a member of Tony's working staff as the head of Stark Industries. Sitwell is on his staff as a representative from S.H.I.E.L.D.
Mm.
I would assume because Stark Industries is a weapon manufacturer and S.H.I.E.L.D. being what S.H.I.E.L.D. is.
Right.
And this is S.H.I.E.L.D. prior to the Hydra infiltration that we're all so familiar with now.
Yes.
So this is that's, although Sitwell is a character, he was a character during all that on there.
Okay.
Jasper, that's his first name, Jasper Sitwell. We see here the first reference of a previous Iron Man, issue 21, as a reference to the conversation that Sitwell has with Tony. We see that Tony is pining over, and if you're familiar with the book, you know that Tony Stark, spoilers, is Iron Man.
What?
And in that Iron Man was pining over Janice Cord, Tony Stark must be pining over Janice Cord.
Right.
And he's doing something so far we can see, throwing the luggage in the car, getting ready to take off. You know, maybe he's going on some sort of quiet time sabbatical or something because of what has happened. Sitwell is talking to Tony because of something that has happened to a female that he was interested in, Sitwell. And her name was Whitney Frost. And that occurred in Iron Man 12. Now we're on issue 23, so issue 12. This Whitney Frost, I know, is a character that still exists now in the Marvel Universe called Madame Mask.
Okay.
And with that name, does that give you a connection to what Tony Stark says about her later on here?
No. I'll wait.
Am I trying to spare him so he doesn't learn of the tragedy that's left her face a ruin?
Yeah.
Now she's called Madame Mask. Mm-hmm. She is a ambiguous guy. She's not a good guy. She's not a bad guy. She, back in the late 90s, she was an Avenger, having been an Iron Man foe for a long time.
Hmm.
And I believe now she has returned to being somebody's foe, but off the top of my head, I'm not sure where the last time I ran across her was. But so she's one of these people that, you know, is, I guess they kind of coast on the fringe of good and bad, mm-hmm. and so it's easy to step to one side or the other whenever the writers need her to play a part.
Yeah, I'd never heard of her, so.
Yeah, it's a gold face plate that she wears, much more ornately done than like Dr. Doom's. Mm-hmm. I mean, it looks close to, it's more like Destro's.
Mm, okay.
You know, it's got actual features mm-hmm. and everything on it. So Sitwell is asking about, you know, the situation that occurred with Whitney in Iron Man 12. Well, Tony, one, doesn't want to talk about that situation, as we see here, because Jasper doesn't know what happened to Whitney, and Tony doesn't want to be the one to tell him. But also because Tony is not in the frame of mind to be worrying about someone else's worries right now. He is caught up with this Janice Cord thing. So he takes off, and there's another reference here. He's referencing that he had a relationship with Janice based on Iron Man 19. They became a thing or a couple or whatever.
Well, he is a billionaire playboy.
Playboy, yes, sir. And, you know, off the top of my head, I don't know. I didn't look back. Issue 19 also may have been the issue where the Titanium Man and her death and all that occurred also. Mm. I'm not sure. I definitely feel that it was recent because, of course, the character is still pining about it. So it must have happened, you know, within a handful of issues.
Right.
Someone is in the back of his car. Tony's car, as he's driving. This may be one of the few times ever that you will see Tony Stark drive his own car.
Mm.
Now that I think about that.
Mm, you know what? Yeah, you. I didn't even...
I thought that was Happy's job.
Yeah.
You know, so anyways, he's driving his car. And somebody races up out of the back seat, puts a gun to the back of his head. And then in the panel that we see the full view of this person, it's a blonde female. And she kind of lowers the gun. She didn't really mean it.
Well, of course not.
She just – she wanted to be sure that a certain thing happened, and it was kind of happening anyway. She wants to get out of town. Tony is heading out of town, so she, like, really didn't need to turn out to force the issue.
I'm sorry.
So she doesn't.
I didn't mean it.
I didn't mean it. Yeah, I was just kidding.
It's a water
kidding,
gun.
Kidding in that Pulp Fiction kind of way, kidding in the car with a gun, right?
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, kidding just like that.
Mm-hmm.
I still laugh every time I see that part of the movie. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to laugh at it, but it just strikes me as funny. Have you seen Pulp Fiction?
I have.
Okay, I'm just making sure.
I just don't remember the scene you're talking about, so that's why I'm like, I have no idea.
John Travolta and what's-his-face in the car with the dude that they drug out of the apartment where they went to get the money because they had reneged on paying for some drugs that they had gotten.
Dude, it has seriously been a long time since I've seen the movie.
Oh, bummer. You've only seen it once?
Pretty sure.
Oh, you've got to see that movie again.
I usually don't watch movies more than once because the second time I know what's going to happen.
Yeah, but it'll refresh your memory so that you can get references like this.
Nah.
Okay. Okay, so we find out that this is Bonnie Parker. And I'm sorry. No, she makes a reference to Bonnie Parker, but she says her name's Cheryl Porter. I'm sorry. I'm making like Bonnie Parker. I think that's a person or like a movie character. She's making a reference to or something as far as the method that she used to get her way and to get out of town.
Bonnie and Clyde? Bonnie and Clyde.
Could be. Bonnie Parker could have been. Okay. But this is Cheryl Porter. And then we see her story. She took up with a really bad character who was a merchant seaman. Not that that's makes him a bad character. But
No. Merchant seamen are not bad characters.
The rest of this tale makes him a bad character, yes, because he is one of a group of men that smuggle. And they smuggled the Titanium Man to the U.S.
Yeah.
She overheard the discussions between her then boyfriend and the captain or someone else on the crew, and then steals away because she doesn't want to be involved in any of that. Mm-hmm. And also decides that she needs to tell somebody.
Yeah, because you never want to be associated with a dirty crop of semen.
No, absolutely not. Dirty semen is bad.
Yeah, it really is.
Flesh missiles and dirty semen. They're terrible.
They are. They wreak havoc.
You get all of that free in one show.
Seriously.
So she also decides that she is going to tell someone, and in blabbing is found out. The person that heard her blab calls the captain of the ship that smuggled the Titanium Man in. The captain calls the mercenary.
Mm.
And hires him to kill her for telling people about them smuggling in the Titanium Man.
Mm-hmm.
And the mercenary is still after her, even though this whole thing with the Titanium Man has played out.
Yeah, because once you take the contract, you see it through to the end.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And actually, he even says that somewhere later on, I think. But that caught me as kind of odd. You know, it's like, well, the Titanium Man has already been defeated by Iron Man. Mm-hmm. You could roll all of this up in one happy ball and everybody just forget about it.
Yeah. But you know what? He was hired for a job. No matter what else happens, that's his job.
So she's trying to get away from the mercenary. And lo and behold, at the beginning of the story, the mercenary was watching Iron Man.
Mm.
So somehow the mercenary has connected all this, I guess through the contract that he was given by the captain. Although at the time that he was hired, I don't know how the captain could have known that Iron Man was even involved.
Mm, well.
Because Iron Man's involvement would have been due to her saying something.
No. Because I'm betting when they smuggled him in, they knew that he was probably going to fight Iron Man. Turns out he did. They know that Iron Man is the hired bodyguard of Tony Stark. Follow Tony Stark, and you may get to her.
Okay, but he was following – originally he was – no. Well, no. He was watching Iron Man.
Yeah.
But he wasn't – okay, so what you're saying is that by watching Iron Man, he'll eventually see Stark.
Mm-hmm.
Who Stark is the one that they feel is connected to her.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I gotcha.
It's really weak, I know, but hey, I'm just trying to. Yeah. I'm just trying to put
it's together. Comic story writing in the 70s.
Yes,
okay.
It is.
Okay. So Tony and I'm sorry, what was her name?
Cheryl.
Betty. Cheryl. Cheryl and Tony head off. Tony says, "You know, I got just the." Just a place that we can stash you, their dame or Maul. We can stash you, Maul.
You know what? I know you were just kidding with the gun. It's no big deal. Come with me to my cabin.
Yeah, there you go. What a playboy.
Mm-hmm.
He is not put off at all.
No.
You know.
No. Once he signs that contract, no matter what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh no! Wait, that was the mercenary.
Oh.
Yeah, so as they're going, we see that the mercenary has tagged he has tagged all of Stark's vehicles with microwave spy monitors.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
That way he can pop Tony's corn.
Awesome. And so now he's following Tony, and he has heard Tony say where he is going in general – even if he doesn't know the specific location of the place that Tony has mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure how that would be helpful, but apparently it is to the mercenary.
You know, maybe the mercenary has done his research and knows that Tony's got a place. I don't know.
I don't know. And I take that back. They insert this gentleman named Vincent Sandhurst into the story. We first ran into Vincent in issue 12 of Iron Man as well. Vincent is preparing to blow up Tony Stark's car as it passes a certain point in its route that Tony Stark just recently decided he was going to go.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently Vincent knew what Tony was going to do in time enough to booby trap the road.
Yes, because he did his research.
Because he's going to blow Tony up.
Yeah, he did his research too.
And the mercenary stops him because he doesn't want Tony Stark killed outright for some reason. I guess because he is supposed to kill him. I'm not quite sure why not.
I don't think.
Seems like it would make his job easier.
But he's not hired to kill Tony. He's hired to kill Cheryl.
Well, but she's in the car.
Well, I don't know.
and he's got it bugged so he can hear her voice.
Yeah.
When she and Tony are talking, so he has to know that she's in the car with him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Either way, he stops Vincent, and we see Vincent's story. I'm Vincent Sandhurst, Janice Cord's lawyer. That's the dead woman's lawyer. Until Stark showed her I was embezzling from her firm, at which point he lost his job. And that all happened in Iron Man 12. So he lost his job, and he wants to kill Tony. Mercenary stops him from killing Tony, shoots him with this gun.
Looks like Han Solo's gun.
Yeah, very much like Han Solo's gun, yes. So the mercenary shot first.
Yes, he did.
Leaves Vincent lying here in the leaves, and goes on after Tony. Close enough, this is occurring close enough, that Cheryl hears something, the gun, but it's not necessarily close enough for them to recognize what it is, but she hears something,
right.
So it's relatively close. In the cabin, we see that Tony has it decked out with a system of lights and alarms that blanket the entire surrounding area.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a little panel with buttons, front door, right side, left side, rear door. That's all they say.
Mm-hmm.
And they each have a button. Outside, the mercenary is there. He's been listening in. So apparently the micro bad guy bug or whatever he called it works inside the cabin also. It's not just on the car. It must be on Tony's person somehow.
It's on the shoe.
Yes, it is. There's a Hulk joke in there, but it's not coming to me. So he now realizes that Tony and Cheryl are both in this cabin. So this is where he wants to go. He's going to break in and whatever, get them both, I guess. Her at the very least, kill them both. Two birds with one stone. Mercenary charges in, and lo and behold, Iron Man is waiting for him, not Tony Stark. And Iron Man tells him that since he bugged Stark's car, Stark knew what was up.
Mm-hmm.
So from the time he left his building after seeing Jasper up until now has all been a play by Stark to get the mercenary.
Yep.
Well, except for finding the chick in the back of his car. That probably was unexpected, but he can work with that.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to roll with the punches, yeah.
Yeah, right. It's never 100% plan. It's, you know.
But I bet he loves when a plan comes together.
Yes. He and BA.
Mm-hmm.
They're fighting, going back and forth a little bit here, the mercenary and Iron Man. We have a panel that shows us that Cheryl is downstairs in a secured part of the cabin. She says that Tony told her that the shelter can withstand anything short of an H-bomb blast. And she doesn't have to let anybody in until she looks at a monitor to actually see who it is.
Mm-hmm.
They won't be able to get in until she lets them in, and she'll be able to see who it is. So they're fighting, and we find out that the mercenary is an expert tumbler.
Mm-hmm.
He also has a blackout mist on his vest that he releases and covers everything in, you know, that squid inky kind of blackness. Interestingly drawn, though, I thought.
I was just thinking that.
Drawn as very, very close, almost concentric circles. So you know it took a long time to pencil that in.
And instead of giving the sense of wind like they can, or a moving air or blowing, this almost looks like I think they were going for the cloud effect.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a pillowy, black, cloudy kind of look.
Yeah, it also looks like they were going for like a billowing.
Okay, yeah.
Which, yeah, it was definitely something that I had not seen them do before concerning, like, what a person can release.
Right. Well, yeah, anything that darkens a room.
Yeah.
I've not seen it done this way. I kind of like this because it adds a certain feel, you know, to the blackness that is in the room.
Well, that and also because it's different, what is it?
Right, yeah.
You know what is in it? What does it do? How bad is it? This is new. This is something we haven't seen. Is this something that he's made? Is this, you know, there's just, while doing it, it raises so many questions about it.
Right. In the midst of the fight, Tony releases an infrared ray from his vario beam, which is the large circle in the middle of his breastplate. And it allows him to see, but apparently not the mercenary.
Mm-hmm.
Because he uses it to locate the mercenary and punch him. Unfortunately, the mercenary has reinforced headgear, so that punch really didn't hurt him.
Yep.
But then he pulls out this weapon and fires a blast of light that completely eradicates that black billowy darkness.
Yep.
And this is a full page spread of dots of different colors all over the room. I mean, that description just doesn't really do the picture justice.
No, you know what I thought of when I saw this?
What?
Dazzler.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, I did too. Sometimes, in the use of her power, it's very similar.
Yeah, you've got the different size circles. You've got the different color circles. You've got the very bright foreground with a very dark background, showing the blacking out of the area because the forefront is lit up. The dots that people see because of a bright flash of light. But yeah, when I saw that, I was like, it kind of looks like Dazzler.
Yeah. Definitely, it's interesting, as opposed to the rest of the rest of the artwork in this issue. This light effect and the previous black mm-hmm. effect had so much more texture mm-hmm. than the standard panels that this guy was drawing. And I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, it really added to the issue. It's too bad that he didn't have other areas where he could have done it or did do it. But yeah, those two effects really made this one stand out.
Yeah, yeah, they really did. So let's see, might be a different thing that he whips out here. This is just a light emitter, and I think then maybe he pulls out the mercenary pulls out something he calls a hallucinogenic flare and fires it at Iron Man. It says it's guaranteed to dazzle all the senses. The mercenary is holding something, and you can't really tell in that panel if it's the same gun that he was holding in the previous panel.
Yeah, it almost looks like
a laser pointer.
I was
going to
say like a flashlight instead of like a gun, like a flashlight, like, you know, the long button thingy sort of.
Yeah. So first he stunned, you know, as it were, Tony with the bright light, and then he confused him, I guess, with the hallucinogenic flare. Tony is Iron Man is laying crumpled on the floor as the mercenary is moving on about his mission. He now pulls out the mercenary, a cardiosonic scanner that he uses to scan the immediate area for any other heartbeats other than his own, I guess, and or Iron Man's. He knows Iron Man is just right over there.
Yeah.
And determines that there is a heartbeat beneath a section of fake flooring.
Mm.
And as he approaches that to try to enter, Iron Man has revived and resumes his attack on the mercenary. They go back and forth for several panels here until the mercenary attaches a magnetized block to Tony's armor that absorbs all the current from the armor.
Mm-hmm.
And then he stuns Tony with a hand-to-hand blow because now the weight of that armor is falling on Tony and his normal human musculature to support because he doesn't have any transistor help to keep the armor up and mobile and everything like that.
Ah, but you're missing a a key point that the bad guy is making here. So it's something that additionally he has. He has the steel-edged side of his glove.
That's what he used to deliver the crippling blow.
Exactly. So while, you know, while the exoskeleton is weighing down on Tony's human body as he's falling, the bad guy is coming in with that steel-edged side of his glove and doing a kung fu karate chop sort of thing to the side of Iron Man's head.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you're absolutely right. The mercenary now, having dispatched our hero, pulls out a kit that contains special makeup that he has devised. And he uses that makeup to turn himself into Tony Stark and goes to Tony's closet and gets some of his clothes. So now, to all appearances, he looks like Tony Stark.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to Cheryl, identifies himself as Tony Stark. She allows him entrance into this area that she's in, but he immediately says, among other things, "Dear, it's all over. Just turn and see for yourself." We cut to Iron Man, who is struggling mightily to plug himself into the wall, because ultimately that's what he does. Blowing all the circuits in the house, but acquiring enough, what does he say? A big enough jolt of current, which is cool because that's the same thing that Mercenary said was drained by that magnetic device. Mm-hmm. So they're using the same electromotive force, at least, in both. Yep. And it's enough to power back up his armor fully, not just, you know, for a one-shot kind of thing like in the first movie, you know, where he only had so much energy and that it was depleted. Mm-hmm. This gives him enough energy, apparently, to function normally as Iron Man again. So
it was a better power grid back then.
Well, whether Iron Man has like an alternator in between his legs that when he moves his legs, it, you know, charges the battery, or
yeah, it could be.
I don't know how it works, but he's charged and he goes to go into this bunker like part of the cabin where Cheryl is. And as he's getting ready to go down, coming up is Vincent.
Say what?
Holding a smoking gun.
Yep. The proverbial and literal.
And he exclaims that he has killed Tony Stark. Iron Man grabs him, throws him down the stairs, probably breaking dude's neck.
Probably.
Nonetheless. And we see on the floor, as Iron Man, you know, gets to the bottom, this shelter area here, we see lying over there next to a gun is Tony Stark.
Tony Stark.
And lying here at his feet with his glasses next to him is Vincent. Tony uses a light now emitted from that circle in his breastplate to illuminate the rest of the room to find Cheryl, give her some hugs and kisses, and they literally walk off into the full moon.
Is it the full moon or is that the setting sun?
Being at night, I assumed it was a full moon.
Was it at night? I thought.
Yeah, aren't they traveling at night when they're traveling to his cabin?
Maybe. I mean, I didn't really get a sense of night, though. I guess. The dark sky and the dark shadows kind of.
Well, yeah. But I mean, there's nothing that says that's night. I mean, that could just very well be day, also.
I mean, one of the panels back when the mercenary was maniacally laughing. Has another orange globe behind him, orb, so...
Yeah, could that not have been a full moon?
It could have been. So I don't know. Okay, I don't know.
Because it's really big.
Yeah.
If they're drawing the sun that big rather than alluding to a harvest moon.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I just took it, and I honestly couldn't give you one panel, you know, as my key. Mm. I just took it that it was night.
Okay. It's more romantic that way. We'll go with that.
Walking into the full moon, yes. And that's, yeah, she's going back to basically the text is that she's decided not to run, that she wants to go try to stand by her man who has gotten in trouble and will more than likely do time for his part in the Titanium Man smuggling ring.
Yeah.
But she's going to wait for him.
Because
as a good girlfriend should.
I was just going to say, as a good girlfriend does.
As a good Moll, she'll be waiting for him. Thus ends the
Iron Man 23.
Yeah, just Iron Man?
Yeah, just Iron Man.
Okay. Because I left off the Incredible Hulk on several times speaking about the previous
book. Well, we all know he's incredible. I mean, it's, you know.
Yeah, but I need to throw out those adjectives.
All right. I understand. I'm sorry.
The Invincible Iron Man. See, I knew there was an adjective. It's the Invincible Iron Man issue 20.
Oh, it is the Invincible. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And without being too goofy, it sounds goofy, but it is important enough because there will be other volumes called just Iron Man.
Right. They change it up.
Or The Incredible Iron Man, or what? And yeah, they're actually different volumes of the book.
Yeah, the Incredible Iron Man, The Invincible Hulk.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah. The Uncanny, or no, no,
the yeah, right, exactly.
The title now called Uncanny Avengers.
The Uncanny Spider-Man.
Yes.
Sure.
Okay. So, what did you think about Iron Man?
All right. Well, first of all, thumbs up. I dug it. Biggest thing, the first thing that really got me when I opened the issue was that this version of Iron Man, I had the action figure for.
Oh, cool.
When I was a kid. The one where, you know, he's got like that thin plating boot and thin plating gloves, you know, with the lines and everything.
Right, right.
But also, the biggest thing was those battery packs on his hips. Those round battery packs.
Yes,
on
yes,
his hips. Okay. Yeah. And I remember that iteration of the Iron Man armor specifically, because I literally had that action figure. So it was just like me at like 10 or 12 having the Iron Man action figure, like either sitting beside me or in my hand, and I'm reading the comic. So that was really cool for me.
Okay. And you could even have pulled out like a G.I. Joe figure and pretended he was the mercenary.
No, I couldn't. That's not going to happen.
Oh, okay.
No, it's not even the same.
No cross pollination.
Nope.
Like that?
Nope. One of the other things that I really liked was the fact that instead of the bad guy, the main bad guy, being the only thing that was adversely happening in the issue, they had this lawyer that pops up that's wanting to kill Stark as well. And out of the blue, it's like, here you've got the mercenary. He's the big bad guy. He's the one that's been hired. He's the one that's going to do the job. He's not wanting to kill Stark. He's wanting to kill Cheryl. And then you flip the page, and then there's this bumbling dude that's about to blow up the car. And the mercenary's like, you're an idiot. Stop. Bang. I kill you. Because you're screwing up my plans. So I kind of like the fact that they were like, let's add another layer to it.
Right.
And then they use that layer later as well. So I liked that. The mercenary, meh. You know, he's like you said, he's probably a one-off. So we'll probably not see him again. And his outfit was just so unoriginal.
Yeah.
I mean, every time I looked at him, I was like, you're just a maniacally laughing, screwed up, you know, Avenger.
But what got me the most was, dude got a funky face.
Well, and did you notice, like, how many times he was like, I keep using the word, but just, like, he looked maniacal. He, like,
yes,
laughed maniacally. Like, it was like they were trying to play him up as being maybe insane.
Maybe. You definitely get the idea that dude's not right.
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, he's
But, I mean, yeah. It's – and in just – you know, he doesn't even say anything. He's just listening to, like, them talking, you know, and he's standing beside that rock, and he's just like, and it's like, dude, calm down.
Yeah. His teeth just killed me. His upper teeth.
They're rather large.
Every time he was drawn smiling, I was like, ugh.
Yeah, he could have been, you know, like the super villain, the maniacal beaver.
Yeah, there you go.
You know?
An angry beaver.
An angry beaver. Exactly. But also, I like...
I'm sorry. I just thought...
Trying to work past it, dude.
No, come on. I just thought, this is the episode that contains flesh missiles, yes. Dirty semen, yes. And angry beavers.
Yes, it does. Yes.
Oh, we covered them all.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. And as we talked about before, those really dynamic scenes with the effects really made this issue stand out from, to be quite honest, probably the majority of the issues that we've covered on the show based solely on that artwork.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, story and writing and everything, you know, put that to the side. You know, if you just say, oh my God, you know, compare this to this, yeah, it's going to be this issue because of those, what they attempted with that art. So that was really good too. So I liked it.
Okay. Okay. Let's see. I agree with you. The light effect and the dark cloud. Yeah. Those just had a level of coolness that we haven't seen in art in a lot of other books. Mm-hmm. Definitely guys, if you have the chance to find a reprint of this, or I'm not sure if it's collected in anything, even if you got, you wouldn't get the same effect if you got the, black and white, reprint of these, because you've got to see it in color to get the effect. It's a different, a completely different texture to the art than what we've seen. Vincent, the upset lawyer.
Yeah.
You know, a reference to Tony Stark doing him wrong in a previous issue that really had nothing to do with Iron Man and a bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, this was Tony Stark looking out for a female friend of his that found something at her company, informed her, this guy got fired for it. Later on, this guy is seeking revenge against Tony Stark.
Mm-hmm.
So that was cool. I like that you get that cohesion of cause and effect in separate issue, in different issues.
Okay, yeah.
You know, it makes the story the story of Iron Man is bigger than this one issue.
It was more multidimensional than just the this and this.
Right. Yeah. Then here's hero, here's bad guy, fights, wins, next issue.
Yeah.
You know, which still at this time is a very majorly used formula for writing comic books.
Sure.
You know, they still are not still, but at this point in comic book writing, it's big multi-book arcs over, you know, 6 months, a year, 2 or 3 years is almost unheard of.
Yeah.
It's a couple issues, maybe 3 issues, and then moving on. But they will bring something in from 6 or 8 issues ago and use it as a part of the story, a character or something that happened, or, you know.
Right, a tie-in.
Yeah, but definitely not a continuing story for like 12 issues, like a whole year.
Yeah.
You know. But they do things like that, though, enough to make you see that this is one big, long narrative, not a whole bunch of short narratives, mm-hmm. by tying back. I like that. I've always liked that about comic books. I like it even more when different books manage to do that. Because then it makes the Marvel Universe as a whole organism. What happens in this book affects that book, you know, rather than just individual. Because you wonder, you know, do any of the other heroes in New York ever get concerned that every Thursday the Baxter Building blows up?
Right, exactly. Or you know, oh my God, the Hulk came into New York, he fought this bad guy, he leveled 13 other buildings, but none of the other people that happened to be there at the time really cared.
Yeah, exactly. You mean to tell me that every other hero in New York was out of town?
And I mean, there are going to be some that quite honestly are going to be like, I realize it's the Hulk, I realize he's supposed to be the bad guy, but come on guys, this is exactly what we try to fight against. Good guy or not.
Yeah, so, and you know, any time that you see that there's a bigger Marvel Universe, I always think that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I don't think – well, we saw it a little bit in the Hulk book with his alluding to the Thor story as far as the absorbing
man. Well, but one blurb box references.
Yeah, you're right. And but as opposed to here in Iron Man when there was nothing.
Yeah.
You would have no idea that Iron Man is really connected to the rest of the Marvel Universe just looking at this issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so... I like that tying into previous aspects, and I think I said four or five. There were three references in there to a previous issue. So that's more than usual. Usually you only get one or maybe two, mm-hmm. but yeah, they threw in three and used them. The Titanium Man, mm-hmm. Vincent, mm-hmm. Janice Kord dying. Overall, I give it a thumbs up too. There still seems to be, as you mentioned about the Hulk, what the best way to term it, I guess, would be a lack of polish of the product, not necessarily of the skills of the writer or the artist, but the book itself as a whole. Every book that we read still seems to possess these just rough edges.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would almost have to think that stuff like that is an editor's job. But maybe at this time, editors had a different job than what I assume would be an editor's job. Or maybe I'm completely wrong and that's not an editor's job. I don't know.
I mean, but yeah, maybe.
It just, you know, I think that's the fairest way to put it. These books just have rough edges.
Well, but now here's something. What we think of as rough edges now may be just because we're used to a certain thing now.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I agree 100%.
What would have been rough edges back then would have been, oh, well, I can see how that could make sense because we don't know how any of this works.
Right, but in all fairness as well, I don't have that experience.
Right.
I have the experience I have, you know, as a 46-year-old man sitting here reading these books now.
Well, no, hold on now, that's not true. Because you do have that experience because you were reading them.
Not this far back, though. I can distinctly remember a lot of the stuff from the 80s forward. The earliest that I have any memory of books is about 74, 75, right about the time that we moved to West Virginia from Chicago.
From Chicago.
Yeah. I have no memory of books that I might have read before that, and if I did, they weren't very many books.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, when I think of the most fully formed, freshest memories that I can pull on are like the early to mid 80s on.
All right. Now,
and even those, though, even those are very different reading and feeling books than these books you and I are reading.
Oh, okay.
And they're only, you know, roughly 10 years apart.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different feel.
Okay.
It really is. My go-to for just that early to middle 80s book, if you just really want to get a feeling about what the writing was like, read Marvel's Shogun Warriors.
Mm.
It pretty much encapsulates all of the memes or tropes or whatever word you want to use for comic books of the time period.
Okay.
In that. But I also try to be you know, as kind as I can be to folks, not saying that, you know, oh, well, you know, that book sucked because that writer was just terrible.
Right.
You know, no, I understand that comic books were still a fairly new medium. They weren't crafted as being the big money draw that they are now.
No.
They weren't crafted as being the road in to making a whole lot of money like they are now via the movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so completely different everything, I would have to assume, as far as the creation process. And I, you know, all of these things I try to keep in mind, but I still, you know, there are still those things that I think that, as creative adults then, they would, should, could have been as capable as creative adults now in correcting these things that I say are rough edges.
Okay.
You know, and that's as much as I try to compare, you know, writers and artists in the 70s and what I am familiar with now. Because I realize that you can't be completely fair in doing that. You have to keep context in mind.
Right, exactly.
Have to. So,
but I mean,
you know,
my biggest thing is, how do you write about something that you don't know about? And consistently keep it consistent.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, the only way that you could do that is you would have to remember what you said before and use that as your truth in continuing to write about it.
Exactly. And I know this is probably going to be one of the worst references that I can make on the show, but if we look at Friends, the TV show, okay?
Right.
There were a horrible number of inconsistencies with the facts about the characters, their pasts, and things like that.
Oh, okay.
Because
from season to season, episode to episode,
exactly.
Okay,
because they didn't, you know, when they wrote, you know, like the script, they didn't write down all the facts and then file it.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, they probably didn't do that with the comics either. But
right, when they needed a history, they just invented it then,
or went back to the comic,
right?
Which the comic then didn't know either.
Yeah, exactly.
So you know,
yeah, I still, you know, there's a lot about 70s comics that I really dig, but you know, there are those things that I kind of cringe when I read. You know, particularly more social or societal references.
Yeah, I love reading those, not because you know, I enjoy them, but it gives such an insight into the crassness. I guess.
Yeah.
Of people of the what was allowed then. And, you know, you compare now and it's like, oh, no.
Well, and the funny thing is, a lot of these creators that we're reading now, that we are reading about that did it then are still creating now.
Yeah.
And they have had to change.
Oh, yeah.
At least the way their creations come across, if not the way they think about it.
Yeah.
You know, so that to me, a lot of times is remarkable because, you know, I'll run across a writer and I'm like, oh, dude doesn't write anything like this now.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, it'd be nice. Now, of course, most of those guys are going to be pretty darn old and probably can't have this conversation. But I would like to sit down and ask them, you know, hey, tell me about the change in your process from 40, 50 years ago to now.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when you sit down to write now, where do you start as opposed to where you started in 1973?
Yeah.
Where's your head at? Tell me where you're at.
And it's got to be difficult for a lot of people to maybe not necessarily change the way they think, but change the way they quote unquote speak.
Well, you have to create as if you're part of that generation. Because if you don't, then your creation will be aged. Now, that might be what you want.
Mm.
But if it's not what you want, and you're trying to pass it off in a market that doesn't want that either, you're not going to be successful.
Which then lends itself to just how great of writers these men really are.
Yeah, that have lasted and can still put out stuff now that is bought,
mm-hmm.
just like their stuff in 1973 was bought.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know it is a totally different audience.
Oh, yeah.
Even though it's the same audience, you know, roughly it's the same demographic.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's a completely different audience.
Yeah, and, you know, if you were to take, you know, the writer then, bring him to modern day and be like, all right, I'll tell you what, I'll be fair – I'll give you a week to learn what you need to know, and then you're going to write a comic series.
I don't think so.
No.
It's time. You know, it's the fact that these men and women have lived it. And so they have, you know, organically gone from A to B to C to D. You can't go organically from A to D.
No. No.
It wouldn't work. It would be very obvious that's what you were doing. So, yeah. Okay. We'll cut off here because we're starting to get a lot deeper into this stuff than we usually do.
Yeah.
So I don't want to go getting all meta. I can't get meta. It makes my head hurt. Okay. So let's see. Next episode, we have lined up to talk about Kid Colt Outlaw 142.
Mm-hmm.
And Ringo Kid issue 2?
Ringo Kid issue 2, yep.
Was it 2? Okay. Now, in kind of a touchback to what I was talking about before at the top of the episode, the books that we cover, to give you guys a heads up, books that we are skipping between the Incredible Hulk, Iron Man, and the Ringo Kid, Kid Outlaw that we will do next episode. These are books that came out the same month of the same year. And if you've noticed, we've been going through books in alphabetical order. So we do year, month, and then alphabetical in that month.
Mm.
We're not covering Mad About Millie. That's a romance. That's a no-no.
Oh.
Marvel Superheroes and Marvel Tales are reprint books. We just don't have an interest in reprints. We want to talk about the issues and stories as they come out. Millie the Model,
no.
Another romance.
No.
My Love,
no.
Another romance. Peter the Little Pest, humor book.
Yeah.
No. If you want humor and light books, there's a podcast that covers the Archie universe out there.
Mm.
I think Archie is like the epitome of that kind of book. Mm-hmm. So
and
you guys can get that over there. Very good. Very good, very consistent show. He's got about 125 episodes. Every Saturday morning, that mofo manages to record and put those things out.
Nice.
It's just him, and they're between 25 and 30 minutes long, usually unless he's got an interview that he has set up. But so consistent about what he covers, how he sets up a show, and when they are released. It's really incredible. But and then, let's see, Peter the – and then we have Ringo Kid. So finishing out the month, it looks like everything else is the kind of stuff that we want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So there really won't be any more skippings. There'll be a couple horror/monster titles here in 2 before we get out of the month of February 1970. So
digging that.
Yeah, I was going to – those be the first
– let's see here. We didn't do it in season 1 that I know of, and we haven't done it yet. That's actually one of the things that I've been looking forward to.
Okay.
And, you know, anytime X-Men come up.
Yes. Yeah, so to give you guys a little – just a heads up, we've got two more episodes, and then the third one from now will have a horror title, and then the fourth one from now will have a horror title and X-Men. So,
yep,
double whammy. And then actually that'll finish out the month of March for 1970. We'll move to April after that. So, little preview, couple superhero shows, horror superhero show coming up. So, a little bit of preview there. Let's see. Levi, what about our quote of the show?
The quote of the show I'm going to let ride.
Okay.
And
all right.
Just to make it easier, I am going to say it again.
Okay, I was going to say, can you give it?
I know. It's like, I'm going to let it ride.
Dot.
And
dot,
that's all, folks.
Yeah,
see
exactly.
You next time.
No, okay. So here it goes. Now, tell me who said it. You can tell me what comic issue it was in. You can tell me, you know, what month it came out. That's fine. But basically I'm looking for who said it. And here is what who said. Mark him closely, my friends. This is the man who spouts the venom that may poison a nation.
Ah, very profound. And I just thought, for those of you that are on Pinterest, every episode I post the covers for the books that we talked about on Pinterest on a board entitled The Marvel Bronze Age. So if you search that on Pinterest, you'll get a board, more than likely mine. I don't know if anybody else uses that name. But all of the covers for these Bronze Age books that Levi and I have talked about are posted there, as well as other Bronze Age books that I might come across on the bi-weekly occasion that I cruise Pinterest just to see what's going on.
And there is a good possibility, Ed, that if they look at those covers, they may have a vision of who said that quote.
Okay. Ooh, so there you go. There's kind of a sideways hint, kind of.
Kind of.
So, Pinterest, the Marvel Bronze Age, a clue to our quote of the show may be on there. So there we go.
All right.
If you want to get that to us because you have it all figured out, you can send it to us, if it's 140 characters or less, at Marvel Bronze Age on Twitter.
Yes, it does seem that we have a plethora of ways to get in contact with us.
We do indeed. You can give us recommendations for our word of the show also.
Mm-hmm.
And Twitter seems to be a preferred place to get that information to us because I believe like 3 of 4 or 4 of 5 have come through Twitter.
There we go.
So, also, the Marvel Bronze Age is on Facebook and Google Plus. Mm-hmm. Pages there. You can leave guesses at the quote. You can even suggest a quote. I'm sure Levi will take it under advisement. No guarantee beyond that. Same as the word of the show. Take it under advisement. No guarantee for suggestions. You can email it to us at themarvelbronzeage@gmail.com. Or you can leave any kind of feedback that you want, even negative if you choose to.
Yes, because we enjoy negative as well.
Yes, at bigtimenoise.com/Marvel Bronze Age. That's the website. iTunes reviews are cool. Now that we're on iTunes, we're on Stitcher. I have recently actually changed over from listening to all my podcasts via iTunes and an iPod to listening to them on Stitcher using an iPad. So
now. Talking about all this iConnectivity.
Yes.
We don't have anything in the iCloud, do we? Because there are some photos of us that...
No.
Okay.
No, I don't use iCloud because it's not very secure.
Okay. Party where we had everyone over?
Well, actually, after you saw those, I told you to get rid of those.
I thought you said you were going to get rid of them.
No. Okay. Well, then I guess I better make sure they're still where they're supposed to be.
That might be a good idea.
They might have been snagged by now.
Ah.
I know we're on Anonymous's agenda, so you never know when that's going to come.
That's true. And I just want to tell him sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
Yeah. Okay. All right, guys. Kid Cold Outlaw 142 and Ringo Kid 2 next time out. And quote of the show. And I think that's everything that we have. So we will talk to you guys again next time.
Sir, peace.
The Marvel Bronze Age podcast is a Teal production, and as such is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Non-Derivatives 3.0 Unported license. The song Super Freaks is provided and performed by the Hammerheads.